Hello, everyone. I'm John McGowan. I am a high school history teacher, an English teacher. We call it a humanities teacher. And one of the things I teach is American Studies. And I teach at a place called Culver Academies, which is in Indiana. And I live in Valparaiso, Indiana. One of the things that I've spent a lot of time thinking about during my teaching career is, what is America? And so I invite you tonight, in preparation for the 4th of July, to think a little bit with me about what's American about America. What makes us who we are as a country? Today is a very important day in American history. It was on this day, July 3rd, 1776, that John Adams picked up his pen and wrote a letter to his wife Abigail. The correspondence between Abigail and John Adams is one of the richest in American history, perhaps one of the best correspondence between a husband and wife in our annals as a country. And on July 3rd, 1776, John Adams said to Abigail, "The 2nd of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shoes, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore." Okay. You might think I'm transported by a little bit too much enthusiasm. Well, he was 2 days early, right? Or we're a day late, or a couple days, right? So on July 2nd, actually, John Adams said that our country was born. Now, what happened? Anybody know why he said July 2nd and not
Declaration of Independence was signed.
Yes, in secret. The representatives of the Continental Congress agreed to the Declaration of Independence, but they did not yet release the Declaration to the public. It still had to be tweaked a little bit, edited a little bit, and then sent to the printer. And then on July 4th, it was released to the public. Just so happens on the day when newspapers were most popular in America, so it was a great PR move. And it was also read in public outside, not Independence Hall, but a place called the Pennsylvania State House, which we now call Independence Hall. So it's because of that day, July 2nd, that we had a July 4th, and that we'll celebrate the 4th of July tomorrow.
That would have been a really weird coincidence of history if they had signed it at a place called Independence Hall.
Yeah. And I want to encourage you, as I go forward to tonight, to interrupt, to ask a question, to make a comment, because my goal is really to prompt you to think about this, and I'm going to just share with you a few ideas that I have and a few ideas that some other scholars have as well. The 4th of July has not always been a happy day for all Americans. Frederick Douglass, on July 5th, 1852, asked this question: "What to the American slave is your 4th of July?" He said that it was a day that revealed to him, more than any other day in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. Frederick Douglass, as you remember, was a former slave. He escaped to freedom in the North and became one of the most important abolitionists in American history. "To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity, your sound of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shout of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgiving, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him more bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. This is not a nation on the, there is not a nation on the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour." So he wasn't very happy with the 4th of July. It reminded him of the fact that he did not have the freedom that he wished for. Now, what is America, the United States? What do you think of when you think of America? What do you think of? What's American about America? What are some of the things that come to your mind when you think of America?
A mixture of people.
A mixture of people.
A certain landmass,
a certain definition of a boundary.
Freedom.
Welcoming.
Democracy. An experiment.
All those are great, right? As we move forward, keep thinking about these things. If I asked my students what is America, or if I asked young people around the world, went on a survey, right, with my microphone, and I asked them what do they think of when they think of America, they would probably think of American popular culture. It is one of the strongest popular cultures in our world today. What would that include? Hollywood movies, fast food, McDonald's. If you've ever been outside the United States, you can always find a McDonald's and you feel like you're home, don't you? It's great. Right? KFC, there are now more KFCs in China than in the United States, which I think is really interesting irony. Think of pop music and iPods. I met an Iranian a year ago in Beijing, and the thing he wanted to show me was his iPod. He wanted to show me all the, right? See, we're not all that far away. I like iPods. They think of sports. They think of American brands and advertising. Think of Wall Street finance and maybe lately a little bit of scandal and worry. Free markets and consumerism. The freedom to earn money, to buy things, to do what you want. Right? This is what brings many people from around the world to the United States. Some of these popular culture ideas. But I don't think that really gets at it, does it? That's not really America. Especially we're thinking of the 4th of July. There's a lot more to it than that. Is it a people? Is America a people? Is it a race or a blood type? That's a tough one, right? Probably not. Is it a place, a country, a nation state? In some ways it is. Is it a culture or a religion? Not really, because these are all things that have defined nations over history, beginning with the first nation states established by the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648.
But you can't deny that there's a certain civil religion.
Yes. All of these things are in part true. Well, let's look at them a second. Okay. Let's look at America as a place. What kind of place is it? Where is it? How did it get to be there? Right? We have a sense of it. You probably have a mental map in your brain about where is America, what it's about. We can point to it on the map, right? Now, what kind of land is it? Could you make a generalization about American landscape? Right? I think you have a vision maybe of Ireland, right? In your mind, what Ireland looks like. Do you have that for America? Look at the satellite image of America, right? Great diversity from the East Coast to the West Coast. And then this great big desert here. In fact, not far from us is a pretty semi-arid region. You just have to look across the lake and we see a very different kind of ecological zone. America has not one kind of land, but many kinds of land. It's so big. Well, how did it get to be where it is? How did it get to be this broad, this diverse? Well, one way of thinking about it is America grew westward. That's the great narrative of American history. Colonists come from Europe, they land, and they move across the land. Now, if you're one of these people, the story is not from east to west. It's actually the other way around, right? You're watching this whole group of Europeans coming and yourself losing what you once had. We can actually look at a map. This is a map from our own government. And we can see actually how the country grew. People thought about this before. It's kind of interesting, right? Here are our original 13 colonies. But that's not the landmass actually we had when we signed a treaty with Great Britain at the end of the American Revolution. By the end of the American Revolution, the United States had all of this land. In fact, one of the reasons why George Washington was a big supporter of the Revolution was that he believed that Virginia should span all the way to the Ohio and the Mississippi River. He had been out there as a surveyor, as a young man, and it was one of his goals. Now, Adams said, it's interesting, this did not become part of the United States, right? This is our friends to the north, the Canadians, who celebrated their National Day just a couple days ago. It was a very close call. Adams believed that if they had moved faster with the Declaration, they could have got the Canadians involved. And when he, in the same letter that he wrote on July 3rd, he actually mourns to his wife Abigail, saying, "Ah, we are so close. We almost got the Canadian provinces to join us, but they didn't. It would take a lot longer for them to break from Great Britain." Soon after the Revolution, the United States also moved into this territory, the Northwest Territory. It was the first act, actually, of the new government, not called the United States, but actually it was called the Confederacy. It was a kind of confederation of all of the states. The next big leap that we all know is this famous Louisiana Purchase, one of the biggest jumps in American landmass in one swoop. Thomas Jefferson bought it from Napoleon, who gained it from some distant relative he gained through conquest in Spain. We should have bought it from Spain, but France got the money so that Napoleon could continue the Napoleonic Wars, kind of tie into War and Peace from last night. Now, the next piece of territory is this one, Florida. Does anybody know how Florida became part of the United States?
Treaty with Spain.
But why were the Spanish willing to make a treaty with the United States? Well, it was during Madison's presidency. John Quincy Adams was the Secretary of State, and he kept pressuring the Spanish, who were in the middle of a war with Napoleon. And a guy named Andrew Jackson went into western Florida to attack Seminoles and slave rebels. And John Quincy Adams said, "Spain, do you want us to keep doing this, or do you just want to sign a treaty? Because either you start settling this, or we will." And it was a very important chapter in American history. At the same time, the United States got the other piece around Louisiana. And then the next big chunk is this one. It was part of Mexico, or part of New Spain before that. And it was a group of European Americans who moved down here at the invitation of the Spanish government and then broke away and joined the United States. Remember the Alamo? Then soon after that, there was a war between the United States, the Mexican-American War. And after that treaty, the United States gained all of the Southwest, and then soon after that, purchased for a small amount of money this lower section of Arizona. So in some ways, you could say this all would have been part of Mexico, except for the United States' really aggressive actions. Then finally, the United States signed a treaty with Great Britain to define this boundary. And you can see at one point it was a little bit more curved than it is now. But it was a compromise, and it was set at the 49th parallel. The result of this was 50 states added over about 200 years. Right? When young people learn about the map of the United States, this is what we think about, right? These 50 states, each with their own history and story. And Hawaii and Alaska being our last states. And then here we also have a little picture of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, and I'll get to that in a second. Is this it? Is this the map of America? Is this it? Is this the only place the United States of America is in the world? No. So but this is what we think of. I think in our mind, we often think of these 50 states. Well, the U.S. has many other territories and global responsibilities. On this side, you see the territories. On this side, you see the responsibilities. It's a pretty impressive list for a country that was born out of a rebellion against an empire. Right? Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, U.S. Virgin Islands, the Marianas. Those are all official U.S. territories. If you're born in one of those territories, you are a U.S. citizen. And then these special responsibilities, everything from Micronesia to the control of the Scott Amundsen Station in Antarctica, one of the largest research stations in the world. We also have treaties with NATO, military bases all over the world, and our embassies are also, like every other country's embassy, sovereign territory. We no longer, though, control territories we once controlled, such as the Philippines, the Panama Canal, and many military bases in Japan, Europe, and now, I believe, we're mostly out of Saudi Arabia, too. Now, we're also even beyond the globe. Now, the Soviet Union has a little bit of space junk on the moon, too, but the United States has left the biggest mark on the planet, on the surface of the moon. And we even set our flag on the moon. Now, we didn't claim the territory, but it was an interesting act. It kind of reminds me of the Spanish conquistadors coming to Mexico and placing the flag and the cross there. We've got the flag and our technology. Alexis de Tocqueville, one of the most famous commentators on America, said, America is a land of wonders in which everything is in constant motion and every change seems an improvement. No natural boundaries seem to be set to the effort of man. And in his eyes, what is not yet done is only what he has not yet attempted to do. In some ways, you could say there are no natural boundaries of the United States. They just continue. It's literally a presence all over the world, but beyond just our 50 states. So perhaps that map image is not the best way to understand America, because the lines start to blur as you get beyond those 50 states. So maybe we can think of America as a people. But what then is this American, this new man? In a letter from an American farmer, John Hector de St. John de Crevecoeur asked, what then is the American, this new man? Right? He is an American who, leaving behind all of his ancient prejudices and manners, receives new ones from the mode of life he has embraced. The new government he obeys and the new rank he holds, he has become an American by being received in the broad lap of our great alma mater. Here, individuals of all races are melted into a new race whose labors and posterity will one day cause great changes in the world. Americans are the Western pilgrims. This is in 1782. It's a definition in many ways that can still work today. But who is an American? What does an American look like? If you've traveled outside the United States, someone may have recognized you as an American. How did they do that? Okay. Here is an image of an American. Is this what you had in mind? Right, this is a Narragansett sachem from the 17th century. How about this one? A pilgrim mother and child. How about this one? Great inventor Thomas Edison. Or how about great Latino performer Jennifer Lopez? Or a Japanese architect? Or Martin Luther King Jr.? Or Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Austrian governor, and a Korean-American golfer, right? Look at the diversity of these faces, right? Could you draw a picture of what American looks like? Is it possible? How about this one? Can you tell me who is the American, or who are the Americans in this picture? Who's more American than an NBA basketball player? The Houston Rockets. Right, this is Yao Ming in the news lately because he's got an injury that may threaten his basketball career. But the person in the middle is Yu Se Khan, and the person obviously on the far right is Yo-Yo Ma. Now, which one of these is an American?
Yo-Yo Ma.
Yo-Yo Ma is fully American, American born, though of Chinese ancestry. Yao Ming spends a lot of time in the United States playing basketball, but he maintains his Chinese citizenship and played for China in the Olympics last year. How about this person? You ever heard of her? She is a U.S. citizen who almost everybody in China knows because she's a TV celebrity. But she maintains her U.S. citizenship. So it gets to be a little bit blurry sometimes. Now, Mark Twain quoted a friend saying about his friend, I am not an American, I am the American. This is an often misquoted or misattributed quote, but it is a wonderful one to think about. What would American look like? Well, Mark Twain is in some ways a quintessential American. But how about this man, Tiger Woods? He's actually my vote if I were to pick a person who's like more American than anybody else because of his very complex background and also his world fame. Look at his background. One quarter Chinese, one quarter Thai, one quarter African-American, one-eighth Native American, and one-eighth Dutch. Right? That's his family background, right? A great melting pot. We see the same thing in our current president, Barack Obama. Langston Hughes had a slightly different view of what an American is. This is his famous poem, I Too Sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America. This poem became an inspiration for a video the State Department created after 9/11 to promote America's image. And the State Department went around the country and filmed people saying, I, too, am an America. I, too, am an American. And it gave a positive image of America's diversity. Though this is a diversity that's been won with a lot of effort and sometimes a lot of violence. So what is an American? Well, Crevecoeur said it was a new kind of person, you could say, beginning by about 1776. It's not a single people, a race, or a genetic type, right? We couldn't type it that way. Couldn't do a genotype of an American. Anyone can be an American, can't they? Anybody could be. All it takes is U.S. citizenship, or somehow to sneak in and be an illegal alien. Now, are illegal aliens Americans? Right? This is a very important issue. Immigration, a huge issue. It defines us as a country, yet there's so much controversy about it. It's something that's, in many ways, still not figured out in America. We all know there's been diversity from the start, from Native Americans that go back 15,000 years, to European colonists, to Africans brought here as slaves and indentured servants, to Asians and Latinos, to Middle Easterners, and just about anybody you can think of. We can find them in the United States. So you could say we're a global society and culture, a melting pot, a tapestry, a patchwork quilt. These have all been metaphors that have been used to describe us as a country. Here is a really wonderful thing. This is from a 19th century newspaper style, the Great American Melting Pot. Here are the ingredients you put into the melting pot. And this is a late 19th century image of all the people in the same dish being stirred by rights and Lady Liberty. Another image is the image of the tapestry weaving all of the strands of our culture. And our final image, actually the one I prefer to all of these, is more of the patchwork quilt. Because in many ways, nobody's given up everything about themselves or their past culture, right? If you look around in American neighborhoods, you'll find that people hold on to their ethnic identities in many ways. So perhaps we're like this famous image by Immanuel Gottlieb, Weizsäcker. We are all diverse individuals in the same boat. Have you thought about that when you looked at this picture before? We often remember George Washington standing there strong with the American flag behind him, almost like the soldiers depicted in the Iwo Jima monument. But there are also all sorts of different people in this boat. African Americans, hunters and woodsmen, perhaps Frenchmen, even perhaps a woman. There's some debate about that here. But great diversity, all of us in the same boat. There's another view of America, though, that I think I want to suggest to you. It comes from a book, The Idea That Is America. And it was written by Anne-Marie Slaughter, who is a professor, a lawyer, and an international affairs scholar. She says, America is a place, a country, a people. All the things we just talked about, all those things are true about America. But it is also an idea. It is an idea of a nation founded on a set of universal values, self-evident truths. Right? Notice this quoting of the Declaration. That come not from blood or soil or skin color or wealth, but from the fact of our common humanity. It is the idea of a nation bound together not by territory or religion or ethnicity, but by a self-conscious commitment to shared values for ourselves and for all peoples. Bruce Cole, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, summed it up, I think, more succinctly. Our nation is not bound by common ties of blood, race, or religion. Instead, we are united by our devotion to shared ideals. What are those ideas that are America? What are those ideals? We heard, I think, a few of them when we first started our conversation. Emory Slaughter lists these ideas. Liberty, democracy, equality, justice, tolerance, humility, faith. All of these ideas were born in a historic moment, the late 18th century, that July 4th day that we'll celebrate tomorrow. But they've also been shaped by historic forces and a lot of human struggle. Americans have really worked at defining what these mean, and they have not stayed the same over time. Let's look at each one of these, and I'd like you to think about whether you agree with these or not. Perhaps there's some other ones you'd like to add to the list. Well, first is liberty, free or freedom. As Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, we all have unalienable rights. This is a word that the founders debated over for a long time. They wanted to make sure they got the right word. These are rights that cannot be taken away. And among these are the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This comes right out of John Locke's two treatises on government, but Jefferson changed the last phrase. It was property. It was property in Locke, but Jefferson changes it to this more broad statement, the pursuit of happiness. And this is a phrase that if you look at the original edition, you'll see lots of cross-outs as they try to come up with the right phrase. And this is one that's really stood the test of time. Now, what are those rights of liberty? We can see them in the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution, which we call the Bill of Rights. We remember them as the freedoms of speech, press, religion, arms, assembly, and petition. We remember the right to trial, to jury, and due process to protect life, liberty, and property. We remember freedom from unreasonable search and seizure, cruel and unusual punishment, self-incrimination, double jeopardy. We can't be tried for the same thing twice. These ideals in many ways can be summed up in that famous national song, which is funny, is sung to the British national anthem. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Perhaps there's no more important right, though, than the freedom of speech. This is a painting from 1990 by Faith Ringgold, where she takes the words of the First Amendment and paints them into her American flag. A very, very profound statement of what America is about.
Would that be a desecration of the flag?
Oh, yeah, great question. Well, she's certainly changing the emphasis mm-hmm. on the flag. Mm-hmm. She's defining it. Yes?
I mean, how would you respond to the notion that at times that has been curtailed, like in World War I, World War II?
I think actually the artist here is a great response. So if this is somehow a sacred symbol, she is challenging her right to speak freely by writing on the flag, her mm-hmm. own words. And I think, and this is something that is constantly being fought over in America, and it shows you how important it is to us. Now, these freedoms have not stayed the same. If you look at the course of American history, there's been an expansion of these freedoms. These are the four freedoms as defined by FDR during World War II, and pictured by great graphic artist Norman Rockwell. They are freedom of speech, religion, from want, and from fear. America has extended rights and freedoms to more people and supported the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Just 60 years ago, the United States signed this statement, which I think was an expansion of what was stated in the Declaration of Independence, but saying that these rights are actually universal. Jimmy Carter said, America did not invent human rights. Human rights invented America. Think about that. But we have to be careful, America, don't we? Because sometimes our own liberty can take away, by exercising our own liberty, we can take away someone else's. So there are some limits to our liberty. We'd like to think that there is no limit, but there is, because we have to work it out together. Another big idea is democracy. This phrase right here from the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, we the people. Alexander Hamilton wrote, we are a republican government. Real liberty is never found in despotism or in the extremes of democracy. Interesting, our founder was not a pure Democrat. He did not want to have pure democracy. In fact, for the first 100 years, the U.S. did not promise democracy, but sought self-government in the form of a republic. Over and over again, the founders talked about having a republic, and which meant that you had a government that was limited by laws and people would vote for representatives who, in a sense, would rule over them. That's the classic Italian Renaissance version of a republic. What they came up with is this system of checks and balances that we know so well, a divided government, which was not only clearly historically in the U.S. Constitution, but goes back to the Federalist Paper number 47 by James Madison. America has had a great suspicion of power. Right? We fought against an empire, against tyranny. Here is a pretty good quote about this. In America, the constitutional restraint on power is as fundamental as the exercise of power. A suspicion of power is ingrained in both the letter and spirit of the American Constitution. This is said by someone who you may have heard of before, Senator John McCain, when he was campaigning just a little over a year ago. Now, if we look at the story of America, not everybody was involved in our democracy. In the beginning, it was just white men who owned property. Though in 1862, Abraham Lincoln said that we are government by the people, for the people. Now, how is he defining people? How do we define what a citizen is? Look at the story of this. Suffrage, or the right to vote, which is one of the principal ways Americans exercise democracy, began with white men who had property in 1787. It expanded to all white men in the 1830s, just about the time Andrew Jackson became president, and to all men in 1865, with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. All women were added to the list in 1920. And then, in a really strange twist, people who had the right to vote had to be re-given the right to vote after the Civil Rights Movement and the Voting Rights Acts of 1965. And then all men and women in America over 18 in 1971. So we can see a constant redefinition of what it means to be a democracy and who can participate in it. But throughout America's history, we've had a participatory democracy, which is included in freedom of association, and by the 20th century, voter referendums, recalls, initiatives, all those things that confuse you when you go to vote, right? But they are a very important part of Americans being involved in a democracy. Now, another big ideal is equality. All men are created equal, it says in the Declaration of Independence. James Madison said the U.S. Constitution sought to reduce the power of factions, right, to create a system where you would have political equality. But equality was not something that happened easily in America. This famous photograph of Samuel Montgomery March for Voting Rights shows you how much it took to get equality in America. It's just one illustration of it. Walt Whitman, I think, better than almost any other American poet, stated what American democracy was all about. You could say, he said, America is a place where everyone matters. In one of his most famous poems, I Hear America Singing from Leaves of Grass, he says, I hear America singing, the varied carols I hear, those of mechanics, each one singing as it should be, blithe and strong, the carpenter singing as he measures his plank or beam, the mason singing as he makes ready for work or leaves off work, the boatman singing what belongs to him in his boat, the deckhand singing on the steamboat deck, the shoemaker singing as he sits on his bench, the hatter singing as he stands, the woodcutter's song, the plowboys on his way in the morning, or at the noon intermission, or at sundown, the delicious singing of the mother, or of the young wife at work, or of the girl sewing or washing, each singing what belongs to her and to none else. The day what belongs to the day, at night the party of young fellows, robust, friendly, singing with open mouths their strong, melodious songs. Notice the diversity of all of these people, the common people. This is what Whitman thought was great about America's democracy. Another big ideal is justice. James Madison said, we should be a government of laws, not of men. And this is often repeated in American politics. George Washington said in his first inaugural address that the rules of order made liberty possible. Without justice, there is no liberty. Power without law becomes tyranny. That's what it says in that long list of grievances in the second half of the Declaration of Independence. We also have another way of gaining justice, and that's judicial review of laws. Right, right now, our Congress is debating an applicant or nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Another big ideal for America is tolerance. Tolerance comes out of religious and political conflict in Europe. Think of all those religious wars, you know, that Luther started way back in 1517. Right? The Europeans had to try to figure it out. And the Americans came of age in the time of the Enlightenment, which had one of the clearest definitions of this tolerance. It began with religious tolerance in the colonies. In colonies like Maryland, for example, it didn't matter what your religion was. Everybody was welcome into the colony. It's been supported by state and federal constitutions. It's been defined by our laws and civil rights. We believe in laissez-faire government, hands off. That's the same kind of dating that I hope my daughter has. We believe that we need to tolerate and to be tolerated. Think about how important that is for all of the different groups and all the different religions and beliefs to make it through American life. Walter Lippmann in 1914, I think, summed it up really well. He said, "The great social adventure of America is no longer the conquest of wilderness. It isn't the story of going from east to west, but it is the absorption of 50 different people." I think it's more than 50 now. Mm-hmm. I love this cartoon. I think it sums up the motto of America that you can find on all of your money pretty well. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Another famous American, Rudolph Giuliani, said that we, as Americans, are defined by our beliefs, not by our ethnic origins. Our beliefs in religious freedom, political freedom, that's what makes an American. Our belief in democracy, the rule of law, and respect for human life, that's how you become an American. That's what he said to the UN General Assembly. Another thing that makes America ideals is humility. America is pretty self-critical. Even though America has not completely lived up to its ideals. This cartoonist, I think, has it pretty well. You can't quite see the caption, but here's George Bush going on a paper route, and he's dropping bombs all over the Middle East, and it says, "Sowing the seeds of democracy." Okay? Now, this is one of the ideals of America, is that we can have people who can create cartoons like this, which criticize our government, criticize our country. The Puritan colonists sought to create a shining city on a hill. You might remember this phrase. Ronald Reagan made it pretty famous. But you might not remember the next phrase, which was to walk humbly with God. James Madison said, "If men were angels, no government would be necessary." Clear indication that he knew that we weren't going to be perfect. And out of this humility comes a great deal of gratitude and thankfulness. Think about that. About America. I mean, are we truly humble? Because humility is often seen in gratitude and thankfulness. You can think of all the Thanksgivings we've had. Colonial Pilgrims, Civil War, World War II. President Harry Truman said it pretty well in 1945. "We give thanks for the humility of free men, each knowing it was the might of no one arm, but altogether by which we were saved. Liberty knows no race, creed, or class in our country or in the world. Our thanksgiving has the humility of our deep mourning for our gallant dead, our vast gratitude to them." James Baldwin said it even better, I think. "I love America more than any other country in this world. And exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." That's a great American attitude. The great Justice Louis Brandeis said, "The courage to stand up for the ideals is the secret of liberty." Right? In order to preserve liberty, we have to stand up for it. The Atlantic Monthly, a couple years ago, even mapped out the story of the American idea. It shows these peaks and valleys. Certain peak right over here during the time of FDR and the New Deal. And then, and what they seem to suggest is a decline of that American idea. I kind of wonder about that. I wonder what you think about that. Another big idea of America is faith. That's certainly something that's pretty important for us here at Holden. But faith can also be defined even more broadly. Right? What exactly do you mean? It's an optimistic belief in progress and ultimate success. But it's also religion. We're a religious nation, a diverse religious faith. Well, I think a kind of leadership of Christianity. Certainly numerically and certainly politically, Christianity's had a bigger impact than others, but we are still so diverse and becoming more diverse all the time. Barack Obama said this, "The genius of America is a faith in simple dreams, an insistence on small miracles that we can tuck in our children at night and know that they are fed and clothed and safe from harm, that we can say what we think, write what we think, without hearing a sudden knock on the door, that we can have an idea and start our own business without paying a bribe, that we can participate in the political process without fear of retribution, and that our votes will be counted." And in Minnesota, are they still being counted?
No.
No, I think it's, okay, this must have happened in the last 2 weeks.
Yep.
Okay. Woodrow Wilson said to new citizens, "You have taken an oath to a great ideal." Catherine Lee Bates, in some ways, said it even better. And I'm missing my musician.
I've been sent by the musician.
Oh, you've been sent by the musician. Okay, great.
Are you ready to sing this now?
Yeah, but I wonder if we can look at the words first, then we'll end with singing it, and then we can have a little discussion. We've sung this song. It's one of the most popular American patriotic songs. If we had an election today of what should be the national anthem, this would probably win over our more martial Star-Spangled Banner. And I want you to just take a look at these words for a minute with me. You remember that first stanza, right, which defines our country. Right? I think if we have an image of what our country looks like as a land, this is it. Probably better than, more powerful than any other. Right? The skies, the grain, the mountain majesties, the fruited plain, the diversity of that landscape. And then we have another phrase. This is a pretty controversial one in American political circles, because it's talking about God and grace, things that not all Americans are comfortable with. But it's one that we sing nonetheless. And then there's this great phrase, right, from sea to shining sea, the sense of America going from one ocean to the next. Right? And now, look at the third stanza. This is one that you may not have taken a look at real closely before. What's it saying about America? It's a little bit less, jingoistic. Right? It's asking God to, it's basically admitting that we're not perfect. This may be one of the geniuses of America. We think that we can, at times, think we're not perfect. We're probably best when we're that way. But confirm thy soul and self-control and thy liberty and law. Interesting parallel, right? Or interesting balance between liberty and law. And then the very last stanza here, a kind of repeat of the first two lines of the second stanza, and then a statement of brotherhood. And again, this famous line, from sea to shining sea. Just to get in the spirit of July 4th, why don't we take a moment to sing this song together with our famous musician.
Thank you.
closes, ends my presentation, but I want to give a few minutes here for any questions or even just flat-out comments that people want to make about these ideas about America, or any kind of comment you'd like to share as we approach the 4th of July.
I taught last fall in Lithuania, a college in Lithuania, and all of the students were from the Eastern Bloc, and I had about 20 in this one class, and I asked them what they thought an American was. And they gave me three things. One was they're generous, they're hardworking, and they're fat.
Two out of three isn't bad.
Yes. Yeah.
That's good. That's good. That's what a wonderful comment. Thank you. Any other kinds of comments, questions?
One thing that I've become aware of listening to some of the political debate recently is that there is a marked difference between what is in the Constitution, which is law, and what is in the Declaration. And the right, the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is in the Declaration, but not the Constitution. And they are completely separate documents. And it's just and to some extent, both the right and the left makes the two literally right to prove the point that they're trying to prove. But there's, the Declaration is not law.
Right. The Declaration is not law, yet it probably more than any is considered our founding document.
Yes.
And defines us. I think most Americans think of the beginning of that document, right, the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness stuff. But the majority of the document is just a list of complaints. Right? We Americans, we love to complain since 1776. Right? So, but it's interesting. Our political leaders have probably referred to more specific language in the Declaration than in the Constitution. The Constitution is a kind of boring thing to cite, except for that wonderful preamble by Gouverneur Morris. It's a pretty bland, legalistic document. Well, I think, though, there's some Supreme Court cases where Supreme Court justices have referred to the Declaration. So it's a part of that kind of living Constitution, even if it's not a formal part of the legal document. But that's a very good point. Oh, over here, I said first, and then we'll go to Luke.
I think it's absolutely amazing that Adams foresaw how important that document was going to be in American history and how people were going to celebrate that day.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Well, Adams is still one of the most remarkable political leaders in our history. In the library, there's a copy of 1776 by McCullough, and a couple of people actually read it the past week. I commend that book to you. It's a wonderful read. And his wife was extremely important political influence on him. And their son, John Quincy Adams, was probably the best diplomat the United States ever had. He is the one who wrote the Monroe Doctrine, actually, and negotiated many treaties for the United States. So very good point.
One of the words that came to me while we were talking was, what is America? It's a vision. Vision always says it's something out beyond us. We're never quite there. Then the question is, whose vision? And we have a lot of visions in this country about what and who we should be. And I often struggle with the relationship between our faith as Christians and trying to define this country politically or legally. And we want to be, it's a land of open and welcome for all faiths and all creeds and so on. And yet we want to exercise our vision as Christians to bring that to bear on our country. There's a conflict there. One of the things we've got to continue to remind ourselves is that the vision of those who suffer deserves a place at the table, so to speak. And we have to expect that we're going to continually become blind. We can't help that, I don't think. Our success blinds us, and our success makes us hungry for more success. We tend to pass laws to benefit the way to success we've already experienced, not thinking that that cuts out some, makes it more difficult. Just an ongoing struggle. So America, to be true to itself, has got to be a land of constant struggle. I don't even like to say that, but I think that's true. Mm-hmm.
And I think we as Christians should have the courage to be a part of that struggle, to try to define what those values are and what our country should be doing for all over here.
Luke. Well, another book that's in the library over there, and one that I would recommend to everyone who has a couple of months free time, is Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, A Team of Rivals, which is primarily about Lincoln and his presidency. And what she says, especially about his Gettysburg Address, is that there's no single document, probably in the 200 plus years since the Declaration of Independence, that's done more to redefine what is America than that short speech. And what I marvel at in the book is how visionary a man Lincoln was, but also how pragmatic a politician he was to be able to reach toward this new vision, this really reorientation of and redirecting of America as the experiment that it is. But at the same time, we haven't really realized it yet. And I'm reminded by a quote, and this one was Gandhi talking about Christianity as a religion that has not been tried and failed, but has yet to be tried. And I would say that America is an idea that has not been tried and failed, as you know somebody is said, the Atlantic is saying, but is maybe yet an idea that has yet to be fully tried.
Now, Lincoln's phrase was that the dead at Gettysburg would create a new birth of freedom.
Yeah.
And I think that connects back to the statement about vision, that Americans have to be constantly trying to and to realize that vision.
The other thing that Lincoln did, he renamed the United States to the United States. Before that, it was always called these United States. So they were separate states who had an agreement to be together. He redefined in the Gettysburg Address that we would be the United States, singular rather than plural.
Yeah. No wonder we teachers still have students memorize that, because every word in there counts, right? Those just two letters added to the changes a lot.
Been recently listening to a biography of Andrew Jackson, who is the least known, really important American leader, I think. He was, when he was at the height of his popularity, he was eclipsing Washington in his popularity and did huge amounts to define, for better and for worse, this country. And one of the things that strikes me over and over again, and he's elected for the first time in 1824, is they weren't sure this country was going to hold together. And then, of course, with the Civil War, it didn't hold together for a number of years. I think that's why I like that word experiment. And when we lose, I like what you said about it's an idea we haven't fully tried yet. I think the further we get away from seeing this as an experiment in common humanity and some sort of humanism, I think the worse we tend to do, both nationally and internationally. But when we're more open to that there are ways of being a nation that we haven't yet explored, I think is when we're more likely to extend liberty and freedom to groups of people at the margin.
Jackson's a great example of those contradictions in our country. He was the he was the man who was for the common man and for democracy, yet he was also the man who fought against slaves, who rebelled and attacked the Indians and created the Trail of Tears. And he's also the person who was against the U.S. bank. And to get back at him, he's now on our wallet all the time. Right? I think he's on the 20, my memory is correct. And he's the guy, president, who fought the Bank of the U.S. more than any other president.
What was the name of the author?
Anne-Marie Slaughter.
I'm sorry.
Anne-Marie Slaughter.
Does she discuss at all the tension between the idealism and the material reality, the economic living? Because I was thinking of Thomas Paine, and when he wrote Common Sense, everyone was staunchly supportive of him. But when he wrote Agrarian Justice, which essentially, in which he essentially identified that
there's an economic problem as well, that you can't have these ideals without changing the economic realities of the nation. Is she at all addressed that?
She certainly, as you can see from the ideas that she puts up there, does not address them directly. And I think that's an excellent critique of these ideals, that they do not think about issues like economic justice, which I think are pretty important for America and for Christians.
I was thinking of Barbara Ehrenreich, you know, and her, this is great, you know, work will fulfill people, but they won't be fulfilled if they're at least reading by and have to do jobs.
Yeah, great book about the American dream is on net getting by in America.
Mm-hmm.
This is where a woman, she goes to, works in minimum wage jobs around the country.
Nickel and dime,
and the subtitle is on not getting by in America. Yeah, thank you.
I think to jump in at this point, though, one of the biggest threats to the American experiment right now is being demonstrated in those places where it's now clear that tyranny, or at least the intolerance of totalitarianism, is more compatible with rampant consumerism and free market forces than American democracy. And we're trying to hold that tension, hold that middle ground between the economic justice issues and the economic liberties and opportunities, and just the out of control stuff that we now see happening in emerging markets like the former Soviet Union, like China, and that these things are actually probably the biggest threats to our liberty, because as corporations and others see what could be in terms of dollar signs profits at the expense of many in these other lands, and see what those governments allow, that threatens, in some sense, American liberty and American democracy as we know it. And it's one of the, I think, the great questions of the next 25 to 50 years.
But do you think that's a moderate phenomenon? I mean, because we've been...
It's not a moderate phenomenon, but the greatest threat exists today, because these are large nations that compete with us in every way, including militarily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is those issues have been certainly debated throughout American history. Been a key battleground.
Yep.
I think we have just time for one or two more comments. Okay, so we'll use that as a signal to close out. I want to wish you a happy 2nd of July on this 3rd of July, and a very good day tomorrow. So thank you very much.
Thank you.